The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast for April 13th. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian, and welcome back. So here we are, Jackie, yet again, socially distanced in the Ear Candy Studios, recording away.
Yeah, it's kind of my big outing of the week. So it is. It's pretty exciting.
Really my only outing of the week. So.
But Peter, you're looking a little different this week.
I am. I had my hair cut.
Yeah, that's pretty good. So all the salons are closed in Alberta,
I think. No, I did not go to a salon. The salon
There's no black market salon going on here.
No black market salon. I was at home, and my 24-year-old son cut my hair. But here's the story, is that my father, when I was a young kid, used to cut my hair. And I don't know where he picked it up, but he picked up a barbering kit, you know, with the razor and the scissors and the whole bit. And he used to cut my hair. And about a year ago, I was visiting him, and he's cleaning out the house in the basement. He said, oh, here's the kit. Do you want it? I said, sure. So I dug it out, and I cut my son's hair last week, and he cut mine.
Wow. There well, we go. Hey, that's good. You guys, maybe we'll make this a family tradition going forward.
Absolutely. Well, I'm not going to post photos of this haircut, although I think it's like a 9 out of 10. What do you think?
I mean, it looks just as good as where you're going before. Hate to draw business away from the last guy. Yeah. Maybe you weren't going for the fanciest haircuts before, Peter.
My son has a future in cutting hair.
Yeah. Well, you know, it comes to, will people do things differently? And I think a lot of people are rediscovering just these little things in our lives that we used to always rely on other people. And maybe going forward, we'll do more independently.
I think so. Well, the whole issue of how it is that we're going to change is something we're going to talk about as we look post-pandemic into the energy future. But before we do that, we're going to talk about, of course, the historic OPEC deal over the course of the Easter weekend, the implication to Canada, and then we'll get to that future-looking stuff.
Okay, but before we do that, I wanted to get an update on your energy file. I know you've been posting new materials to your vignettes to your online museum. So can you just give us an update on the project?
Yeah. Well, we've been posting almost on a weekly basis some of the new stuff. And if you haven't signed up to energyfile.org, go sign up. And there's my pick of the week that I post every week. We tweet it out. We put it on LinkedIn as well. And some of them obviously are on the pandemic theme and the theme that relates to geopolitics and OPEC and so on. So check it out.
Okay. I'll put a link in the show notes because I signed up and I started to get the emails a couple weeks ago. And it's been just a fun diversion, from everything else going on take a step back into time.
Yeah. It's not overly frequent, but once a week we put stuff out. And I've been getting good feedback on it.
All right. Well, let's talk about the OPEC meeting. So there was nonstop meetings over the long weekend, and it was a little distracting. I had to continue to watch what was going on. In the end, OPEC cut 9.7 million barrels a day of global production, and that's the OPEC Plus group, including Russia and others, for May and June. And the most interesting thing is not only the size of this cut, which is historic. They've never had a cut anything close to this, but the duration. So after the first couple months of this 9.7 million barrels a day, it's going to decrease to 7.1 million barrels a day for the rest of 2020, so six more months. Mm-hmm. And then for all of 2021, it's going to be 5.8 million barrels a day. So this is kind of unprecedented in terms of committing to cuts of this magnitude for that long.
Let's put that into context. First of all, again, we've talked about it many times, pre-pandemic, the world's oil consumption and production was around 100, 101 million barrels per day. OPEC had, production was a little bit more because OPEC had constrained by how much?
They had around, if you didn't count Iran and Libya, because you're assuming maybe those barrels just weren't available to the market, there was probably around 2 to 3 million barrels a day of spare capacity.
Right. And then Saudi threw open the taps to unprecedented levels. And so this 9.7 million barrels a day, which includes Saudi, is off of that peak or is it off of the pre-price war peak?
You know, it is confusing. With the exception of Russia and Saudi Arabia, it's the level that these producers were producing back in October of 2018 when they first agreed to start cutting. Mm-hmm. But there was a change to the baseline for Russia and Saudi Arabia, which is now 11 million barrels a day when it was 10.6 before. But I think the best way to look at it is based on what they were producing in Q1 of 2020 before all of this changed and we had the coronavirus. And in that case, it's about a 8 million barrel a day drop for the whole group over what they were producing in the first quarter of this year.
Right.
And so it is a very significant cut.
So from an OPEC plus perspective, so the entire group produces about 40 million out of that 100 million barrels a day. And so within this group, the almost 10 means that they've cut back about 25%.
Yes, about a quarter, almost a quarter.
Yeah.
And, you know, the interesting thing is the cuts are not equal. If you look at the baseline, Russia is making a very big cut, 2.5 million barrels a day relative to what they were producing in the first quarter of 2020, mm-hmm. where Saudi Arabia, who was doing the vast majority of the cutting before, remember, many weren't compliant mm-hmm. with their cuts before, is making a much smaller cut relative to that level, maybe 1.2 million barrels a day. So Russia is actually taking a very large cut, which is quite surprising, right? They have been the laggard, I would say, in the group, you know, signing up to smaller cuts, not actually delivering on them.
And they've been the most, I think, leery or hesitant in terms of supporting the United States shale gas industry by cutting. And, you know, it was really their walking out on the OPEC deal pre-pandemic that was the catalyst for Saudi to start the price war. So in many respects, the Russians really started this whole thing. And now they're looking at the situation. So
it's a major change here for Russia.
This is no longer a price war. This is now trying to manage a demand collapse. And in that regard, we'll call it 10 million barrels a day just for round numbers, is not nearly enough because the phenomenon of self-isolation that is around the globe and the slowing down of commuting, airline travel, the economy in general means that we're not consuming 100 million barrels per day right now. We're consuming, what, 60, 70?
Yeah, I mean, by most estimates, it's down 20 to 30 million barrels a day. So somewhere between 70 to 80 million barrels a day. That's temporary. Like, I don't know that that will stick around for the whole quarter. And the other issue is, by the way, these cuts start in May. So we're still going to potentially have a lot of oversupply for the rest of this month, which is going to fill storage tanks. So that is why there was this discussion, because it isn't large enough, about the G20 getting involved. And there was a meeting over the weekend with many of the G20 countries, including Canada. Now, what came out of that meeting, although going into the meeting, there was a lot of talk that there'd be some commitment made by this group, countries like Canada and the United States would commit to some sort of reduction to help balance the oil markets. But coming out of it, there was no number put forward. And there was a Globe and Mail article by our natural resources minister, Seamus O'Regan, who said he didn't make any specific cuts. But he did say in the article, the exchange of numbers will come at some point, but this did not happen in this G20. And there is an idea that there would be some agreement for a cut. I don't know that there'll be a formal one. I think these countries are going to cut a lot, as we've been talking about. I think between US and Canada alone, we'll probably see between 4 or 5 million barrels a day of cuts to production due to economic reasons, not forced by any government policy.
Well, economic reasons, I mean, let's just be honest, price at the current level, I don't know, $25 to $30, WTI price, Texas price, is just a brutal hammer to shut in.
Yeah. And then, you know, in reality, it's not even economics there. As we've talked about, there could be logistical reasons too.
So, you know, the reality is, okay, this sounds all very historic, 10 million barrels a day, but 30 needs to be cut. So where's the other 20 coming from? The assumption is that out of those non-OPEC plus G20 countries like Canada, United States, we're going to get another five. Okay, 10 plus 5, 15. We're still nowhere near 30.
Well, there is one other solution that that could come out of this G20 group. We'll wait and see, is that countries will step up to fill their strategic oil reserves. So each of these countries has these reserves of crude to help them through energy security issues. They may have additional capacity to add more crude, and they'd become buyers of crude to help soak up more of this.
Well, if you have the ability to do so, the storage to put it in and the cash to buy the oil, I mean, it's a bargain at the current price.
Yeah. In one of these stimulus packages, the United States had put in some money to fill the strategic reserve up, and it didn't get accepted, right? So there's also the politics of it.
Is
it going to be approved by the government and all the different people that have to buy into it? And maybe that doesn't happen in the time we need, because remember, it's really the next few months. So if you can't sort of get this happening in the next few months, it's less relevant.
Yeah.
That said, though, I do think the fact that the duration of cuts is long and big it will help. So let's say we do build storage, and I think we will over this quarter. Mm-hmm. The fact that the OPEC group is saying that they're going to cut another 7 million barrels a day for the rest of the year, assuming demand comes back in the second half, that will help to bring down those storage levels. So we could be running at a deficit in the oil markets.
Or another way to think about it is that the storage levels don't build up as fast.
They don't build up as fast, and they will. And if they build up, they get drawn down, though, by the fact that, you know, assuming these countries do deliver, they would be undersupplying the market in the second half of the year.
But the reality still is OPEC or NOPEC, the free market producers in particular, are going to be cutting, especially the ones that are inland, because there's just nowhere for the oil to go.
Right. And you know, in some respects, that might be why Russia made such a big cut too, because there may be logistical issues there that they're basically going to do this anyway.
Right.
Now, I don't know that that means they'll do it later on, but in the moment, there's lots of places in the world that they will have to shut in because of logistical reasons. And by the way, we did get some new data from the U.S. that I wanted to share, that as of April 3rd data, we just got it last week, U.S. refined product consumption was down by 1/3. So down 7 million barrels a day. So this isn't theoretical anymore. We have
real
data.
It's like 1/3, yeah. It's on 20 or 21 million barrels per day. So that's jet fuel, diesel, gasoline.
It was mostly gasoline and jet fuel that drove that.
That's the commuter fuel and air fuel. Yeah.
And so that's happening all around the world. And so we're seeing that demand destruction, and therefore producers that are hooked up to these refineries are going to have to slow down their pace of production.
There we go.
Now, oil price didn't move up much. It's up about 50 cents.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing, is the market is basically saying, okay, that's nice, but 10 million barrels a day is a long way from 30.
Yeah, I think, and demand is still uncertain, right? Even what's going to happen in the next quarter, is it going to all rebound? Is it going to continue to be quite slow for the second half of the year? We've obviously still got this big oversupply in April. How much storage is there going to be? I would just say, you know, will the OPEC countries even make these big of cuts? Like, these are big numbers. We've never seen anything close to this.
Well, I think they're going to, as I said, there's a sort of these formal gymnastics around who's going to cut and who isn't, what the quotas are. But behind the scenes, you produce and there's nowhere to put it. I mean, it's you're going to have to cut more. And I think that's the situation now if we think about Canada, which produces about 4.5 million barrels per day, that we've talked about this in our prior podcast. If there's nowhere to put it, you are going to have to cut. So where are we with that?
So our view is that somewhere between 1 and 1.5 million barrels a day probably needs to be cut. The 1.5 would be the equivalent of 1/3 of our production, which would relate to what we're seeing in terms of the demand side. And so far, public announcements that we have been following add up to close to 400,000 barrels a day by May. One problem we have is many producers have signed up to contracts for April, and we're not seeing as many cuts in April. But by May, we think it could be that high. And I'm sure there are many more that aren't being made public.
Right.
And I expect over the next month, we're going to get a lot more information in terms of additional cuts.
So if we were to cut, this is Canada, in proportion to the demand loss in the United States, especially the Midwest and the Northeast, where the coronavirus has hit the hardest, then we would be shutting in potentially 1.5 million barrels per day, 1/3, which is greater than the cuts that the OPEC countries are making, which is about 25%. Is that?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. As a percentage, we would be doing that. Now, the difference is we're not going to probably cut. When demand comes back, we're going to be producing right away. And their agreement is saying that even into the second half and even into next year, they're going to make big cuts. By the way, that's the part I question, that there'll be compliance. When we get out there and demand is actually growing again, are they going to make those kind of cuts?
But, sure. Yeah. I mean, we've already had countries like Mexico being very reluctant to cut, and the propensity to want to, what we used to call it, cheat on your quotas will be very high, especially if the price starts to go up and the consumption starts to come back in any meaningful way before the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So, shall we talk about the future?
Yeah, future of energy and what this pandemic might mean for the future of energy. Are we going to stay on the track of going to a greener world? Are we going to regress back more to not moving forward in terms of our goals and reducing GHG emissions?
Yeah, well, the emissions climate agenda, which was so strong pre-pandemic, has certainly taken a backseat given the severity of the pandemic. And then some of the questions as well, are we going to roar back on that agenda once it's once the pandemic is put to bed? For one thing, the Glasgow COP meeting the big climate change meeting, which was supposed to happen in the fall of this year, has been pushed back to 2021.
Yeah, and that's a big deal. That was supposed to be a very big meeting. This was going to be the meeting where countries revisited the goals they had made back 5 years ago, and they were supposed to make even more aggressive targets for reductions, even though they really hadn't delivered that well on their first set of goals. And so this was supposed to be a really critical meeting. It makes sense that they delayed it because there's a lot of people that go to this event from all over the world. Like, these events have 15,000, 20,000 people. Right?
Yeah. No, it's not the right time, even though it was in the fall, to be able to do it. I think it was a good call. And by September, we're still going to be having a lot of discussions about the economic fallout out of all of this. Now, that does tie into the potential for stimulus into the renewable sector and so on. But we'll talk about that in a minute. Let's just talk a little bit about what people are saying today. So, for example, the International Energy Agency says that things like video calls, the Zoom calls, et cetera, are creating much higher electricity demand, people watching streaming video and so on. So variable electricity is definitely up. And so it also begs the question of whether or not that type of lifestyle change, are we going to do more Zoom calls in lieu of travel, is a big question as we come out of the pandemic. I mean, I certainly think the necessity of business travel is going to be substantially reduced for quite a while.
Well, I was thinking even this OPEC Plus meeting, they did it all on video and they had shown pictures of everyone discussing everything. I don't think it's the same, but I wonder going forward, it's much easier logistically to hold these kind of big meetings this way.
Yeah.
So you might see more of it. I think people are starting to learn this technology does have some real benefits.
It certainly does. And I think that in terms of what's called virtualization, in other words, virtualizing ourselves and holding meetings like that is a trend that isn't going to go away. The only question is, to what extent are we going to go back to the old way? We can talk about that later. I think we're going to talk about that on subsequent podcasts. Let's also talk about what some of these agencies like Bloomberg New Energy Finance, IEA, and so on are saying about renewables. I mean, clearly, capital budgets have been slashed or put on hold. In some instances, workers can't be going out into the field or get the supplies that they need because of supply chain disruptions and so on. So the expectation of deployment of renewables, whether it's home solar installations or wind farms and so on, is down this year. There's no question about it. So spending on renewables was already flat coming into this, significant, $300 billion a year or so, but it's certainly going to be retreating over the course of the next 12 months. And the question is, how will this capital scarcity play out in the energy world? Will stimulus programs from the government target renewables and the green energy movement, much as it did post-financial crisis 10 years ago?
Especially in the United States, where they put out a fairly big package. And I would just add even less spending on other types of things that would have reduced GHG. So, for example, think about the oil and gas industry. There were a lot of work going on to reduce methane. Now, I don't think these companies generally will have the money to act on those over the next year or two, where they would have otherwise. And so, it's much broader than just renewables, I think, in terms of the impact to the outlook for GHG emissions.
And then there's the personal wallet and personal capital spending decisions. We know that the unemployment rate is going through the roof right now. Many people laid off, not a lot of money in people's pockets, not a lot of propensity to spend. Car sales are going down. Therefore, EV sales are going down as well. And so another question is, when the mindset to buy a vehicle starts to come back, will people buy an EV, or will they look and see that the price of gasoline is cheaper than ever because there's so much abundance and stick with our car? So these are the type of questions we're starting to think about. I would say that, electric vehicle sales, Tesla had a great month in China in March. But assuredly, their sales are down worldwide like everything else right now.
Yeah, not a time to buy cars for a lot of people.
No.
And then I think there is a conservatism, like when you're unsure about the future, it's easier to stick with the tried and true. Now, here on the other side, though, I don't know if you've been watching some of this on social media, Peter, but there's been a thing about people sharing clean air pics.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing.
Some of them are made up, right? It started with, in one city in India, they were able to see the mountains for the first time because the smog had lifted. Mm-hmm. And then that started people doing pictures like, I can see the Eiffel Tower from India and things like that. But now that people have experienced cleaner skies, cleaner air, do you think that there's going to be more resistance to transportation using hydrocarbons than before because they realize the cost of it in terms of air quality and way of life?
Well, I definitely think that having a taste of clean air and skies is going to be a powerful force in people thinking about changing their use of fossil fuels. I mean, I almost think we needed that because pre-pandemic, really, if you don't know what clean air looks like, it's not something that you can aspire to now that you know. And I have to say, I mean, I've been in Asia many times over the course of the last 10, 15 years, and it really is oppressive. Mm-hmm. The smog in some of these big cities. So
I agree that people enjoy the clean air, but the problem is to have it today, we have to live very different lifestyles.
Oh, we do.
Yeah. So I think most people, if they were asked, do you want to continue with your current stay-home arrangement and never leaving the house, or do you want a little bit dirtier air? Most people would choose they want to go out and go back to the lives they had.
And I think it'll come back gradually. And as I said, it just depends if people are going to have enough money to say, oh, wow, I love that clean air, therefore I'm going to go buy, say, an electric vehicle or other types of things that reduce emissions. We shall see. These are the big questions that will emerge once we have a better handle as we exit the pandemic, what the economic destruction has been. But there's no question that similar to after the financial crisis, there was like a two-year period where people were not spending a lot of money on durables and capital items and so on and so forth. And there was a regression back to sort of the old way of doing things.
I just want to say that that's an important point, how much economic destruction there is, because that will impact how much people have to spend, but also how much governments have to spend.
Right.
And a lot of these moves to cleaner air are going to come through government spending and policies. And they may not have the appetite or the tax income to do that.
That's right. That's right. It's really, you need capital to make changes to energy systems, whether it's building more electrification, migrating to renewables, or just the personal decision to buy things like an electric vehicle. So there's three pathways possible that we see going forward. There's a progressive transition to the new era, much as we were in the past. And, you know, what I diarize, and we're doing a lot more work on this, is that every time there is a global level crisis, society does emerge changed with potentially even different sets of values. And depending on what those values are, and depending upon the availability of capital, and depending upon the availability of technology, people do generally shift the way they live, work, and play. So one of the things that I see coming out of this is that the notion of supply chain security is a really big one. We're sort of finding out that all this globalization was really nice to make products cheaper, but that when we are all intertwined too intensely and we get into a crisis, people tend to hoard things, shutting down borders, and it puts into question your ability to get all the way from medical supplies. And energy is not exempt from this. And one of the things that we saw post oil price shocks of the 1970s is that all of a sudden, energy security elevated right to the top. There was a big let's get off oil campaign, and many countries saw what was available at the time, which was nuclear power, and said, we're going to go to nuclear power. Countries like France were very aggressive. Many other countries were too. And so if we think about the pre-pandemic social forces that were driving transition, it was overwhelmingly climate change and environment. But as we come out of the pandemic, we are going to have to take a look at how society is changing and what the shuffling of the issues are. It could be that energy security is going to be a bigger issue, whether it's our existing oil supply chains, as I said, depending upon the damage that's done to our oil reservoirs and what that happens as a consequence of the shut-ins. Or we may say, you know, we want to have greater security through diversification into more electrification and so on. So we shall see.
So this would be a scenario where it would be a even faster progression to maybe not just green, but more energy security aspects of
energy.
Well,
it's possible. Yeah. And I think that, so if you think back, is there to other big periods of change? Like, let's take, for example, the oil price shocks of the early 2000s when the price of oil started shooting up to $100 and $140. we actually had an era there of telework came in where people tried to do the equivalent of what back then it was Skype and other things and working from home. It wasn't as effective as it was today. Then there was a lot of people that were vanpooling and trying to figure out different ways of mitigating the expensive cost of commuting. It didn't really stick. There was a regression back to the status quo once the price of oil came back down. And so, you know, you really have to have an impetus of an availability of alternatives and the capital to make the alternatives. And that really didn't come till after the financial crisis, as I said, where the stimulus dollars started to become available to support change in terms of energy transition, because climate change around 2010-11 had been elevated to a much higher level.
Right. And then the money was there and it went towards really helping to kick off where renewables are today. I would argue if the U.S. didn't spend that money at the time, I don't think renewables would be, you know, on the learning curve as far as they are today. So it made a big change.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's the next scenario?
So the next scenario would be like a pre-pandemic status quo, I'd say. So that would be very similar to coming out of that $140 oil type of scenario, is that we gradually, I still think it's going to take 18 months to 2 years. We start commuting as much as we did. We start flying again. We have pent up people who want to go on vacations because they just want to get back into things, and that there's no real impetus to change. And if we have a situation where the price of oil products like gasoline and diesel and jet fuel are low, then I think we're probably going to go back to some kind of pre-pandemic status quo.
And I can see that. I mean, I think we're going to have a lot of spare capacity. I mean, if these numbers are right and OPEC keeps, you know, near 6 million barrels a day off the market here for the next 2 years, that's all spare capacity, right? Which generally keeps prices low, and we may have that higher inventory. And I mean, this is a temporary situation. Why wouldn't people go back to the lifestyles they had before? Assuming that there's, you know, I think the thing that would be important for this one to happen is there would have to be a strong economy so that people have jobs and that they can go back to their previous lifestyles. But assuming that there's a V-shaped recovery to the economy, oil price is low, maybe the green agenda is a bit more on the back burner because people are now worried more about the economy. And I could see that one happening.
Yeah, I can see that happening. And actually, the third alternative is sort of regressive transition where you go backwards, actually. And I can see this happening as well. So the regressive transition is, as we come out of this, with a lot of personal wealth destruction, a lot of reining in of spending by governments because there just isn't a lot of money. The economy is really stagnating or in longer-term recession. The price of gasoline is cheap, and therefore we start just actually consuming it more than we were, and electric vehicle sales and things like that sort of dry up. Mm-hmm. And there's another regressive thing that I can definitely see coming, and that is the return of the geopolitics. The whole energy independence or energy dominance movement of the United States now really regressing, and the United States and Western countries being more dependent again on Middle Eastern and foreign sources of supply like Russia, et cetera, once we come out of this. And I think that that's going to feed the energy security narrative again that we had 15 years ago.
Well, yeah, you can definitely see it. I mean, most estimates are that the U.S. will be down 2 or 3 million barrels a day by the end of this year. You know, those tight oil wells decline. So if there's not a lot of investment, even lower next year. So they go from the world's largest oil producer, you know, at this moment to being maybe third.
They're not going to have any capital, right? I mean, the equity capital had already dried up pre-pandemic, and now the debt market is reeling. And there's a string of bankruptcies and so on as a consequence of all of this. So the if you don't have any capital, one can see that the production in the United States, even Canada and other Western countries, is going to retreat and is going to be backfilled by the OPEC plus type countries. And so the whole issue of geopolitics and energy security is going to come forward again. And that will be a regressive transition, actually.
I think, though, another thing that would be necessary for this would be a struggling economy, you know, so that governments don't feel like spending a lot of money, people don't have a lot of money, and they just go with the cheapest type of energy, and that's number one.
Well, true.
You know, so, you know, there are perspectives that this could result in a recession that goes on for many years, and I think that would definitely increase the chances of that regressive transition as well.
Yeah, people definitely regress based on price. In other words, if they go to the cheapest possible alternative.
So we've just presented our listeners three potential very different scenarios. What do you think is the most likely path?
Well, I think it's a hybrid. I think that what's going to happen is it's going to be regressive to status quo somewhere in between there over the course of the next year, potentially a little bit longer. I think that we are going to not have a lot of money in people's pockets to transition on the consumption end and on the infrastructure end. I think that there will be stimulus programs that will come out of government that will target infrastructure for green-related energy projects, but that they're going to take time to build out. So I see near-term regressive behavior, but longer-term, longer-term meaning 3 to 5 years out, I actually could see an acceleration into more of the transition into greener, cleaner technologies.
As a result of spending that's decided today that takes that long to really impact.
Yeah, if you think back to the financial crisis, there was several hundred billion dollars into wind and solar and technologies. But it really wasn't until 2015, 5 years later, that the impact of all that was felt.
Okay, so it takes time for that spending to really change the energy structure. So Peter, you just answered all three. You said it's going to be all three of them, but the time frame is different. So you're saying initially over the next few years, somewhere between pre-pandemic status quo and maybe even regressing a little bit, but because of this government spending, it may be a few years down the road, we start to see things accelerate on the green side. I felt actually when I thought about this question, it would probably be between the status quo and the progressive transition. And I said that because if we get a bounce back in the economy, if we don't go into a recession and that people have jobs, I think the stimulus spending will just put us on the track of a bit more money going into the green. And at the same time, if people have the money, they may continue to invest in that. But I do see your point. If the economy is slow at all, I think the chances are a lot less.
Yeah, I think the chances are a lot less in the near term. So I think it's a phased combination of all three of those things. I see near-term regressive behavior because people will migrate to the cheapest alternative.
Right. And you can see that with this COP meeting, right? Like, I know it got canceled for reasons of you can't bring that many people together at this time. But I also think governments have a lot on their plate right now. Do they really want to sign up to much more aggressive targets when they haven't even delivered on the ones from 5 years ago?
Yeah.
When they have all these other, the health crisis, but also economic issues in their own countries. So I think it just puts it to the back burner, at least for the next year or so.
Well, it does. And you know, by the way, our emissions are going to be down proportionally to our energy use here over the course of the next couple of years. And I mean, right now, we've accomplished the Paris targets in 30 days, let alone 30 years.
Yeah, right? But not sustainable.
It's not sustainable, right? So, but I don't think we're going to see consumption levels rise back up to where they were before for probably a couple of years.
Because people's behaviors will change.
Well, people's behaviors have changed, number one. Number two is just the lack of, I'll call it the wealth destruction.
Yeah.
The wealth destruction effect that happened, which is far more severe than it was in the financial crisis. And that took like 2-3 years for people in North America to get back on their feet and spending again in a meaningful way. And Europe, it took even longer.
Well, a little factoid is I was looking at the data for the U.S. unemployment figures. It took almost 10 years for the U.S. to get back to the employment levels that they had before the financial crisis. And so there's going to be that many more people who aren't working. That just results in less spending in the economy.
Right. But one thing we'll dig into in subsequent podcasts is, okay, we've talked about how the post-pandemic energy world in general terms may evolve, but we should focus in on how the post-pandemic oil world will evolve, because that's, you know, we already talked about the geopolitics and shift, but the way the world's oil producers are going to shake out of this very ultra low price and the OPEC cuts and so on is going to be different from the way it was before.
There's definitely some unknowns in what that supply picture is going to look like, who is going to be supplying
and here in Canada, what the structure of the industry is going to look like, what kind of companies are going to be the producers of the 2020s now is going to look different as a consequence of this. What will the U.S. producers look like now that they are capital constrained? I mean, they were our biggest antagonist in many ways out of the Permian. And if they have no access to equity, less access to debt.
And lower prices mean they really can't grow? Because honestly, if we're going to keep prices below $50, I don't think there's going to be a lot of growth from U.S. producers without access to other capital.
No. Well, it's essential to think about all of this stuff right now as we try and think of the post-pandemic future. So continue to stay tuned.
Yeah, we'll leave it to another podcast. Thank you for joining our podcast. If you like this podcast, tell someone else about us and rate us on the app that you listen to.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.